May it please the court, counsel, audience. My name is Pamela Dayton, registration number 19735. I'm a deputy state public defender. I represent Mr. Garcia Castaneda. We request this court to reverse Mr. Garcia Castaneda's convictions in this case for the reasons stated in the brief. I will address in this argument the first two issues and rely on the briefs for the remainder. I'd like to reserve about 3 minutes of rebuttal time.
3 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
Done.
Excuse me. This case raises these questions. If a person accepts a ride in another person's car, and that car is pulled over by the police and drugs are discovered inside, can the passenger challenge the legality of the stop? And is the passenger guilty of possessing the drugs just because he is in the car when the drugs are found? This is what happened to Mr. Garcia Castaneda. He was a passenger in a car driven by an acquaintance. It was very late at night and he was sleeping in the passenger seat when an officer pulled the driver over. The reason for the stop was that the driver was allegedly weaving. The officer testified that he saw the driver cross over the white line once, and he saw the tires touch the white line twice. And for that, the officer stopped him. The officer ultimately issued no ticket, but started asking questions about, do they have any drugs? Do they have a large amount of money? Do they have any weapons? He ultimately obtained consent to search the car. Mr. Garcia Castaneda waited in the freezing cold while the officer searched the car, and then, finding nothing, went and got his drug-sniffing dog to see whether or not he could find something hidden. When the dog alerted, the officer knew there was something in the car, and he began to dismantle the dashboard. Ultimately, he found 5 kilos of cocaine, triple wrapped in saran wrap, foil, and duct tape, hidden in a secret compartment behind the dashboard, behind a rug and some cloth, extremely well hidden from view. Mr. Garcia Castaneda was arrested, charged, convicted of possession of the drugs, and is now serving 14 years in prison. The Fourth Amendment protects citizens against unreasonable searches and seizures. When an officer stops a car for a traffic violation, that is a seizure. That stop is a seizure under the Fourth Amendment. Seizures require reasonable suspicion that the person has either committed a crime, is committing a crime, or is about to commit a crime.
Is the passenger seized?
Yes.
As well as the driver?
Yes.
Passenger is not free to leave?
Passenger is not free to leave. That's really the issue. The first issue in this case is Mr. Garcia Castaneda attempted to challenge the legality of the stop, and the trial court ruled that he didn't have standing, that he wasn't permitted to challenge the legality of the stop because he was simply the passenger. And in the trial court's view, only the driver would be able to challenge the stop. The trial court was wrong, clearly wrong. The U.S. Supreme Court had issued a decision just a couple months earlier making clear that passengers are seized during traffic stops and they have the standing to challenge the stop.
Would I be correct, Ms. Dayton, that your argument here is that anything happened that was fruit of the poisonous tree?
That's correct.
And would I also be correct that your colleague across the way here cited cases that say the passenger would not have standing to challenge the search of the car unless there was some possessory interest? And would I be correct, your argument is that would only apply if there was sufficient attenuation and the consent here doesn't matter?
That's correct. The cases cited by this state in this case all deal with situations in which the person is challenging the search. In this case, my client is challenging the stop. And if the stop is illegal, then everything after that, unless there's sufficient attenuation and the consent is valid, would have to be suppressed. The second question before this court is governed by the Due Process Clause of the United States Constitution. And that is that it requires convictions to be supported by substantial and sufficient evidence so that a jury could reasonably find beyond a reasonable doubt that the person was guilty.
Is there any evidence in this record as to how long the defendant was in the vehicle?
I don't recall that they addressed the specific time frame, but I do know that there was evidence that he had accepted a ride with the driver to go to Las Vegas and back again. So, and I don't know what that time frame is.
I know there was some testimony about going to Las Vegas, and I know the prosecution argued that was a sham. Was there anything else about how Mr. Garcia Castaneda ended up getting in the car, or anything about whether he knew the driver, Mr. Ochoa, or anything? Was there any more to indicate how he ended up in the car, or do we not know anything about it?
I'm trying to remember the difference between what I have learned separately and what the record actually states. I believe there was something in the record about Mr. Garcia Castaneda. You know, it was simply an acquaintance of Mr. Vargas, and I don't know if it was a friend of a friend or not, and learned he was going and asked for a ride because my client's family has family in Las Vegas. And I think if the record establishes that, that's probably all it establishes. I don't think there was much more information in the record than that.
While you've got your stop here, Ms. Davis, sure. I'd like you to respond to something. And I'll tell you candidly, Mr. Fuller over there will hear it too. I have a lot of concerns about this case. I think it's a difficult one, and I think it's a close issue. I suppose the argument for the state here would be, all right, may well be the evidence is weak, but the standard is not a lot that they have to show on sufficiency. So I think they would say you got a car with no heater in it, which, you know, a trained drug enforcement police officer says that's a sign. Your guy sitting there with a blanket over him, which would suggest he kind of knew he was prepared for the fact there would be no heat in this car. You have at least this testimony. You can weigh the strength. We'll let the jury weigh the strength of whether they crouched down and looked guilty when the drug sniffing dog went in the car. You have the cop's testimony about here's kind of how mules work. Why, you know, again, I won't comment on the strength of that, let's assume that evidence is somewhat weak, but why isn't it enough to let a reasonable jury infer knowledge?
Well, each of the items you mentioned are, first of all, susceptible to a number of interpretations. So I'll try to remember them all. The fact that there was no heater working in the car. You know, yes, the officer testified that frequently is the case in a drug courier situation, but that also happens to average citizens who simply, you know, their heaters break and they don't have money to fix them. So whether or not you can infer from that this car was somehow associated with drug trafficking, I think is very questionable.
So let me, and I'll assume reverse my question. You probably can give me a pretty good reasonable inference, innocent explanation for each of the things I cite. So
yes, I could.
Yeah, let's assume that that's true. Why, I think your argument would be that shows, therefore, no reasonable jury could conclude that Mr. Garcia Castaneda had the requisite knowledge. But why can't you argue it the other way to say, if there's a reasonable inference that would allow the jury to conclude the guilty knowledge, why, as we as an appellate court, cannot we say that's enough, that the reasonable jury could, they had two reasonable choices, one is innocent, one is not so innocent, why can't a reasonable jury go with the guilty side?
Well, conviction requires proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And if it's just that the evidence could go either way, there's no way to achieve that standard. The kind of standard you're talking about is a preponderance of the evidence, where it's, you know, 51% versus 49. You can't really put numbers on proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but it's much higher than that. And the requirement is that the evidence be substantial and sufficient and not based on speculation or multiple inferences. So where you're dealing with a standard beyond a reasonable doubt, I think this is not sufficient.
Thank you.
In this case, I would urge the court to look at the flip side as well, to all those items. You have a situation where drugs are not visible. There's no odor emitted from them, so you can't see them, you can't smell them. You have no fingerprints or any other physical connection to the packages and my client. And you have no statements by any witness, including my client, that indicates any connection, any knowledge of the drugs. This is a situation where the officer who was actively looking for drugs and knew what the signs are, knew what they looked like, knew what they smelled like, couldn't find them until he got the dog. So I think that the lack of evidence is what is striking in this case. The officer's testimony about how, you know, my client and the driver crouched in what he called a defeated position is also extremely subjective. I mean, that was his read on it. If you think about that, that posture could, as I said in my opening brief, mean a lot of different things. And the most reasonable interpretation, if you assume it was a response to the dog's alerting, is, oh no, something is wrong. I mean, it doesn't indicate at all that they had any knowledge of these, the presence of drugs prior to the dog's alert. So
excuse me, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Judge.
I didn't want to interrupt you in the middle of your statement.
You're down to about 220.
With about 220 left, I want to ask you this before we run out of time. The people argue that the language regarding mere presence without additional links and evidence in Feltus versus People mm-hmm. was overruled by People versus Bennett by the Colorado Supreme Court. How do you respond to that argument?
Well, I addressed that issue in my reply brief. There's actually a case from another division in this court called Dwyer that expressly rejected that argument when it was raised some years ago. I'm forgetting the date now, but it was quite a long time ago, and it was rejected by a division of this court. As far as I can tell, it was never raised again in a published case, and the Supreme Court has never deemed it cert worthy. So with 1 minute and 30 seconds remaining, thank you.
Well, I have some power over that. Would you reset the clock for 3 minutes? Your turn, sir.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Paul Kaler. I'm a first assistant attorney general in the appellate division of the Colorado Department of Law. I'm here for the people in this case.
Mispronounced your name, Mr. Kaler.
The Supreme Court's been mispronouncing my name for about 20 years now, so you're fine, Your Honor. Ms. Dayton's said actually some things I certainly agree with. She always makes good points. The question here depends on, though, the difference in function between a trial court and an appellate court. As this court knows, findings of fact, if there's any basis in the record below to support them, this court is bound to follow those findings of fact. Issues of law, of course, this court is in a superior position to judge issues of law. And the lower court is not entitled to any deference at all in those issues. And as issues of application of law to fact, this court is obviously in the superior position to do that. I think what goes down on both issues are factual issues. Concerning the suppression issue, I reviewed the trial court's findings of fact in the suppression order, and it made a series of significant findings. First, that the reason that the police officer stopped the defendant's car was because it slowed when he saw it. When it was in the middle of the night, came over a rise, he saw the police officer there, the vehicle slowed, and the police officer pulled behind him, and he started acting a little bit nervously. He started swerving a little bit, went onto the shoulder a little bit. Secondly, he stopped him, he talked to them, the driver gave his driver's license, the officer gave the driver's license back, and he said, you can go on your way, and the driver put his driver's license in front of the console. And then the police officer started conversing with the driver and the defendant, and he asked him, do you have any drugs in this car, do you have any money, all sort of loaded questions, although sometimes people answer funny things. And then he said, do you mind if I look in the car? And they said, no, both the defendant and the driver said, no, go ahead. So they walked and they were standing ahead.
Why isn't that pretty good evidence they don't know there's any drugs in the car?
Well, it was well hidden drugs. And I've seen cases over the last 20 years where people think they have great hiding places. They think nothing's gonna happen, think some dumb cop on the road can't find something that's...
Well, I know that. I mean, I'm aware of that. But isn't it some indication they don't know it's there?
Oh, sure. I think it's some indication, Your Honor.
Mr. Kennedy, can I back you up a minute? In terms of the validity of the stop, I would like to address that. And tell me, how do you distinguish, I recognize, the Tenth Circuit case in Gregory? It seems like the facts were pretty close. The Utah statute was quite similar to the Colorado statute. I mean, here, I would be willing to bet, you know, anyone who drives, who sees a cop over the rise, slows down. I don't think that's any suspicious. Yes, he went over the, you know, line a foot or so. As I recall in Gregory, if I remember right, the guy crossed the line and said, I was pouring myself a cup of coffee. Sorry. You know, why is that a reasonable suspicion to make a traffic stop? And how do you distinguish Gregory?
Well, Gregory is out-of-date case law. Since Gregory was decided, the United States Supreme Court decided in the case of Wren that the subjective intent of a police officer is completely irrelevant as to whether the facts of a stop are objectively reasonable.
Let's take the objective, and I don't remember the exact language of the Colorado statute, the traffic statute, but it kind of says as close as possible to within the lines or some vague language like that. So why is, you know, kind of sliding over a little bit and crossing over the line once, why is there a reasonable suspicion to stop?
Well, in Wren itself, as the court may remember from having read it, the defendant in Wren was driving a car in a downtown area someplace. He stopped at a stop sign. There happened to be a plainclothes police officer just stopped there. He noticed the car stop and wait for what the officer thought was an unusually long time before he proceeded through the stop sign, 20 seconds. That doesn't sound like the world's worst traffic violation. And then when he went through, he sped up a little bit. He seemed to take off a little bit. The police officer stopped him, and for Mr. Wren, he had all sorts of drugs laying out on the front seat of his car that the police officer was able to see. The Supreme Court in that case unanimously, surprisingly in a search and seizure case, said the unusual stopping, 20 seconds, I'm not sure anybody's ever gonna get ticketed for that, plus the speeding up as he took off, that provided the police officer a good reason to stop the car and just say hello. Here, we can argue, and even in Wren itself, some of the evidence that was presented, and I think it was happened in the District of Columbia, they brought in police manuals saying you don't issue a ticket in such and such situations. The Supreme Court unanimously said that's just irrelevant. If a person driving a car does something that can look to a reasonable police officer as a traffic infraction, that is sufficient in order to give the that is sufficient to justify the police officer's stop of the car. And, you know, that's why I think the Gregory case, in this case where we talk about manuals and stuff like that, that's one of the reasons that the Supreme Court said in Wren, we don't want to, that's that just is crazy making talk, that we don't have any time to do that. And it would turn a case on whether one police department's manual said this stop is permissible in this situation, whereas another department said, well, don't even bother with that. And the Supreme Court said, that's just as crazy. What you need to do is look at the objective facts. If the driver of the vehicle does something that gives a police officer an objective reason to stop the car, then that's sufficient for the purposes of search and seizure. So the driver of this car gave the police officer an objective reason to stop the car. And then...
And almost every driver who drives for a mile does.
I do that all the time too. But that's not the test, Your Honor.
I understand that.
And then once that stop, which we say is valid, was completed, the police thought you may go on your way. And then he started talking to the defendant, and defendant and the driver said, you can search our car if you want to. And that provided justification for the search of the car.
First, assuming just for purposes of argument that the stop was improper, would you say there was sufficient attenuation here?
Yes, Your Honor. When the police officer handed the driver's license back to the driver and said, "We're done, you can go," if there was any causation that broke the two parts of the stop apart sufficiently to not invalidate both the defendant and the driver's subsequent consents to search the car.
While I stopped you, I'll jump to the heart and then I'll try to leave you alone. I kind of gave you a heads up of what is troubling me in this case. And I think it's a tough case to make that there's sufficient evidence of knowledge, to tell you the truth. I would appreciate if you would respond to Ms. Staden's argument here. And she says, you know, the stuff you rely on, the officer's testimony, the no heat, all of that, everyone, I think, probably is capable of, or can be reasonably inferred, have a totally innocent explanation. Assuming for the purposes that's true, that you can infer guilt, you can infer innocence. How is the evidence here sufficient? How is it not a reasonable doubt as a matter of law? When you've got no explanation how he got there, or, you know, was a guy sleeping in the car thinking he was going to Vegas in a car with no heat?
Well, first of all, there's two things. I'll make my legal argument first. All sorts of actions by a person in a criminal case can have innocent explanations and have guilty explanations. Back before even I was a lawyer, in a circumstantial evidence case, which this was, the prosecution bore the burden of disproving all alternate hypotheses of guilt disproving all alternate hypotheses of innocent other than that of guilt. So if that were the case, Ms. Dayton would have a pretty good argument on that. But now we don't have to do that. Circumstantial evidence is as good as direct evidence. And circumstantial evidence can be very strong. I remember Henry David Thoreau, the writer, said some circumstantial evidence is very strong, as when you find a trout in the milk. You know, and I think we have a trout in the milk type case here. This was it appears that the defendant in this case was sleeping at the time the car was stopped, but he had told the police officer that they were tandem driving the car back from Las Vegas, and this just wasn't a regular car. It was a car that had been specially modified with a purpose-built secret compartment to transport controlled substances.
Was there any evidence that the defendant had any idea that that was the case?
He adopted an "oh rats" posture when the drug dog alerted on the cocaine hidden. That's evidence there. But also the fact that the defense counsel brought out through one of the police officers who was an expert in the mechanics of drugs transporting that this was a significant amount of cocaine. This was a purpose-built vehicle. The presence of the comforter and the plug-in heater, floor heater, was evidence that they knew that the heater would not be working, and they were driving through Utah and Colorado. It was February. It was cold. You wouldn't be driving a car that way. And the mechanics of transporting drugs across state lines is you send people who you can trust, to deliver the drugs to their endpoint, and who you trust to keep their trap shut should the cops find you.
Does that argument apply, though, equally? I know the government on the federal side makes this argument frequently, too. I suppose I can accept it to a point on the driver. The driver should know. But why would it apply to the passenger? Couldn't you equally say that the kingpin who's sending these people with the drugs doesn't want them to know for two reasons? One, they may steal it. This was a large amount of drugs. Two, if they get caught, they snitch. So, I know you've made, I hear your argument. I know it's made, and a lot of courts have bought it. But it concerns me some, at least with respect to the passenger. Why is it, and maybe my question is, did the officer testify at all about the distinction between the passenger having knowledge and the driver having knowledge?
He wasn't questioned about that. But again, I think that falls into the old school sufficiency test of having to disprove all alternate hypotheses of innocence. I think that's the test.
We'll look it up.
You'll look it up. It's one of those legal formulations that it's impossible to remember. And also, I don't think the test should matter at all, depending on whether a person is behind the wheel of the car or in the passenger seat. First of all, the defendant said that they had been taking turns driving, so it seems somewhat unreasonable to say if the defendant had just woken up at the last driver switch and was then driving, the evidence would be sufficient for him, but not for the guy who was then being the passenger. But it doesn't matter. It shouldn't matter that way.
Was there any evidence, Mr. Kerr, about how whether one person was asked first, and the driver was the one who was asked to drive, and then he said, "Want to come along?" Or
the defendant, I guess, told the police officer that he just had accepted a ride to go out to Vegas to see some family members, and then he saw them and they came back. And
there was no other evidence about
it. No, and the defendant did not present any evidence from any family members that he had in fact done that. But still, that even if he had presented evidence of that, that would not have stopped him from having a dual purpose for his visit. He could have gone to visit family members, and he could have picked up some extra cash for helping transport back $100,000 worth of cocaine or so.
You say he could have. He could have done anything. Don't you have to prove that he knew that the drugs were there?
Sure. I think that's what the police officer was talking about, the mechanics of the cross-state drug transport business. You drug dealers get people to do that they can trust. I guess they could. I guess there could be some testimony. I don't know if there is, that you could fill a car full of innocent dupes.
Who owned the car?
It was a third party, who we don't even know who he was.
So you don't know who the third party is? We don't know which of the two knew the third party.
Pardon me?
We don't know which of the two knew the third party?
No, we don't know, Your Honor. So we don't even know if that's a real name or an alias or whatever it was.
It sounds to me like you are arguing that if, for instance, I get in a car that's in the same condition as this because I want to get a ride to Las Vegas, and I see a heater in the floor, and I see blankets in the seat, and I see that the dashboard is a little bit loose, that I should ask questions about that because I should have some suspicion that there are drugs.
Or maybe hidden
in the vehicle.
Well, when the drugs are found, you might react in a way that would indicate that you were surprised, like you'd look, turn to your friend and say, "What the heck?" Or as opposed to like going, "Oh, they found it." The defendant's own reaction at the time,
he didn't react
the way an innocent person
would. The way I read the record was, "Oh, they found it."
I think they crouched down with their hands in their head.
Okay.
So that's like, I see that as an oh rats kind of a reaction to being caught. You know, and certainly cases can have various strengths of evidence, but on appeal, the question is not whether you think, if you were sitting on the jury, whether a group of appellate judges reading the testimony on a piece of paper would think it was sufficient to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. The question is whether there is more than just a mere modicum of evidence, whether the prosecution met its burden of demonstrating at least a sufficient amount of evidence as to each essential element of the offense so that a reasonable jury could have found that. Appellate courts, I would imagine, think all the time, and I've worked on cases where I thought the evidence was a little bit thin, but we don't have access to the witnesses. We don't see how people, how they spoke. We just see their words on the table, on the printed paper, or now pixels on our computer screens. And that's, we have to be very deferential. And that's this court's responsibility, is to be deferential, because while it's in a superior position to make, come to conclusions about issues of law, it's in a far inferior position to make conclusions as to issues of fact, just because words on a page do not match in any way, shape, or form seeing witnesses testify live in a hearing about the evidence. And in this case, a jury of 12 thought beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant had knowledge by the, because of the fact that he was in a drug transportation vehicle, and he acted a way a person who was in a drug transportation vehicle would react when they got caught. And I think that's more than sufficient evidence. And that's, I guess that's all I have. And I guess I'm out of time too.
Thank you, Ken.
Thank you very much.
Counsel.
They're applauding for you, Ms. Hayes.
I just wanted to respond to the question about whether or not we know who the third party was who owned the car. And we do know that. The testimony from the officer at the motions hearing, I believe, was that he asked the driver he asked my client who owned the car. My client said, "I don't know," and turned to the driver and asked, "Whose car is this?" And the driver told my client in Spanish who owned the car, and my client then told the officer, and it was a Mr. Lopez.
Registration matched.
Like, and the registration matched this person's name. So clearly, in this case, the driver knew the owner of the car, and the if anybody knew anything about these drugs, it's likely those two. My client was just present. I'm very concerned, as I suspect the court is, about the level of evidence in this case and what it would mean if this was deemed sufficient. And I think about our kids, you know, going to parties where things may be not in their view, and yet they could be held responsible. I think about any of us getting into a car, as Judge Hawthorne said, and we have to be suspicious. We can't just assume that, you know, this nice person who's giving me a ride clearly doesn't have much money because his car looks ratty and he hasn't been able to fix this heater. We have to now, if we buy the state's argument, assume that this might be evidence of, you know, hidden drugs and not get into a car or have to do some investigation first. It makes far more sense to keep the burden where the burden is, which is on the state to prove an offense beyond a reasonable doubt. These constitutional rules are designed to protect all of us, and I ask that you reverse Mr. Garcia Castaneda's convictions.
Thank you. I thank both counsel for their arguments. The case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.